This is CIUT 89.5 FM, the University of Toronto Community Radio Station, broadcasting live 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, from Hart House, University of Toronto.
Vibe Collective, CIUT 89.5 FM. It's another Saturday in the T-Dot.
It is.
And I am your co-host, Jams. Joining me, my co-host,
Mally, a.k.a. DocuVixen.
Adrian Worrell.
Kemba King, still having sinus issues, so when I breathe hard into the mic, that's just the reason why.
But, you know, I think that can be an effective sort of way of engaging people. I was interviewing somebody, I'm not going to say their name, recently, and having heard them speak and they do that, it's kind of like you're waiting to, what are they going to say?
Well, my mother was cornrowing my hair because I'm trying to get that like grade school picture day look with my turtleneck and my gold chain, which you'll see when I open up. Okay. And she's like, your allergies are bothering you again, aren't they? I can tell by your breathing. And I'm like, thanks, Mom.
Aww.
You know, so.
Yeah, it's rough.
I just like to tell people because when my mother calls me out on stuff, I'm like, okay, other people are noticing it too. Thanks, Mom.
Aw, that's nice of Mom. Well, for those who aren't familiar with us, we're the Vibe Collective. We're heard every Saturday from 3 to 5. From 3 to 4, we normally engage in roundtable discussions. We talk about things like decolonization, social justice, the culture of resistance, identity, and social justice, environmental justice. I think I said that already. And then from 4 to 5, one of the DJs or several of the DJs brings you music to move you. And I'd also like to welcome to the studio, rolling in fashionably late, as usual.
That's my apology. I was trying to warm up the muscles that don't make my bike go forward to get up the stairs. It was very cold outside.
That is Adnan Hussein, everybody.
Hello.
Also known as DJ Badnan.
And a winter bicyclist. Cyclist, yeah.
It is,
a bicyclist.
Last 2 days have been a bit rough, got to say.
Have you been riding the last 2 days?
That's how I get everywhere.
Crazy, man.
It's, you know, they say, I think the second that you do something stupid often enough, you have to start making it sound like an ethical choice. So I'm like, I'm not going to ride public transport. I'm going to move myself.
Even if it's minus 15, I'm going to be out there.
And it has been. Last night it was kicking my butt. It was so cold. And that I was just on foot. I can't imagine being on the two wheels.
It was bad. Although I got some good advice from a friend to apply Vaseline to anything that's exposed. Although then I feel sticky throughout the whole day.
Vaseline's like a recurring theme for us with you. Because remember, we were talking about the sinuses and you said inhale the...
Oh, that was
Vicks. Vapor.
Right? Oh, Vicks, vapor. Yeah.
Which
we're talking about petroleum.
Vaseline with you.
Yeah, okay, thank you. Okay, thank you.
So. But that's funny because... What are the ethics behind petroleum jelly?
I know.
This is what we were talking about. I'm like, I'm going to buy some eucalyptus oil and do that.
Or shea butter and you can mix
other oils. Olive oil or something.
Yes, for your skin. I was talking about my
Oh, for your sinuses. Yeah.
And it's shea butter's not so good for sinuses.
Yeah, I was like, how would I
that doesn't work.
Yeah. And how do they make
tried it?
It's just like petroleum jelly is just like freaking nature. Like,
that's
what like do they make? How do they make
that's
it?
That's a steak, like a foundation in many people's homes.
So, I know.
Like,
Yeah, absolutely.
I have, like, there's a jar in my house, like...
I made the mistake of about 4 years ago buying the baby scented one.
Ew.
And it just takes years to get rid of Vaseline, right? And so I'm always staring at this thing and I'm like, do I want to smell like a baby's backside today?
Like, what part of the petroleum is used? Like, I don't know.
No. It's
a mystery.
It is very bizarre. I think we need to do some research and then do a show on petroleum jelly. Because it's a staple in so many homes.
Yeah.
And it's like a cultural thing for a lot of people.
Yes,
right?
Definitely.
That's like, I'm like, I don't even know if I want to talk about this in a bad way. It's like when you start talking about Oprah or Obama, it's like, you're like the outside, right? You're
Whoa.
Like... You don't like
with
Oprah?
Don't.
You think Obama's problematic? Vaseline is not a good thing.
Petroleum jelly.
Petroleum?
Are you radical?
No, like we're making a joke of this.
Totally.
But seriously, there's certain times I don't talk about certain things. I'm the radical vegetarian, you know, holistic person.
You know what? Because next you're gonna say something bad about Buckley's, and we're in real trouble. You know?
Yeah.
I dare you.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I with the concerns over parabens and now palm oil and everything, so it's like maybe petroleum jelly is the way to go.
What's wrong with palm oil?
They have to destroy orangutan habitats to get it.
I didn't know that.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't use palm oil, but...
It's apparently pretty bad, too. Yeah.
And there's what? There's like two left in the world?
something like that. And they're like, you know, these monkeys are taking up our palm oil grown space. So... Yeah, the orangutan population is getting decimated by this explosion
for
palm oil. Yeah,
lovely.
Wow.
That's why like it's become the new thing in our household that anytime I go to pick something up, sort of Luther will take a look at the thing and she's like, palm oil. I don't think you can have this. And I'm like, okay, like how about this hand cream? Parabens, can't have that. I'm like, oh.
Well, and there was another one for all the vegans out there. There was an article about quinoa.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I read that article. There was
the
a response article to it.
Yes.
So I'm still cool with quinoa. Yeah.
What do you think about the two
what
articles?
What was it about?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So it was saying, I'm trying to remember because I read all the time.
The first article was about the
it was affecting the price in Bolivia so supposedly poor people couldn't afford it.
Well, the indigenous people who have relied on quinoa for time immemorial and have been cultivating it for time immemorial.
Them too.
Yeah.
No, but that was who it was referring to in that article.
Yeah, right? It was like it was more cost effective for them to grow it and sell it versus eat it themselves. And two documentarians who are doing a documentary in Bolivia responded saying, you know, have you interviewed anyone in Bolivia? Because this has not been the experience. And I spoke, like the one guy who was speaking on behalf of them said, I spoke to someone 2 days ago and they're still eating quinoa. So it's like... I'm just like,
but I mean, isn't that sort of like epidemic with all products with the global system? Yeah.
But I think if you have
to export,
right.
That's the nature of global exporting.
I think if it's a valid thing, if it was true, then I would, you know, I would feel a way and make different choices. But if we are within the spaces of where we're critiquing certain things like Monsanto and we're putting out information, it's just like scare tactics, then I don't subscribe to that, right? Like, so if people in Bolivia are making money, farmers are making money off of the sale of quinoa, that's a healthy product, go ahead and do that, right?
Yeah.
But
and it's such a great substitute for meat protein.
Yes.
Quinoa is, because it has a lot of good protein in it and other good things in it. It was sad to read that article, but I did read the counter and it raises those questions, those ethical questions, like you're saying, Melinda. I mean, the global food industry right now, and the, I mean, we
with every product.
Have you all seen Life and Diet? Yeah.
My favorite.
Yeah. So just thinking about that and like the, you know, the milk farm and the bananas and like how all of that agriculture gets skewed and pirated. Right?
Yeah. Well, I mean,
food security is a major issue, and it's like, how do you keep people in line and check economies beholden if they can feed themselves? So it's very important to, you know, for the powers that be to interrupt that and make sure that things are routed through them.
Yeah.
And so that was really driven home in Life in Debt, you know, where it's a point of like, we're just going to not grow stuff, or we're only going to grow it for foreign markets while people here don't necessarily have, aren't getting all the calories and nutrients that they need. You know, so it's a...
And making it more expensive to buy locally.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
You know, making imported produce cheaper.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, this is also at the core of a lot of the explosion of drug industries in places like Afghanistan, is because poppies are just a hardier and easier to grow crop, and it's a cash crop. And whereas something like wheat just won't have the kind of return that you'll want to see. And so a lot of these farmers are growing heroin just because it's
makes money.
Consistent. It makes money. It'll take care of you. And the markets of the West are willing to buy. So
that's like coca in South America. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah. I've been kind of, I guess, struggling with the idea of eating locally. To Toronto and whatever that means. And there's this little mini documentary going around the social networks. It has like a blueberry at the start. About eating local. And I think that's something that we all have to kind of consider. I was in my favorite town center, Malvern Town Center, last night.
Hello.
Yes. In the West Indian store, because you know I like my West Indian store. And I was talking to the gentleman there. He appeared to me to be of Sri Lankan ancestry, and we were talking about turmeric because I was buying turmeric. And he was talking about all the ways in which to use turmeric. And we've talked about turmeric here, but like he's talking about the fact of making a salad out of it, right? Like there's all these little pieces of knowledge here that we need to talk about.
I was just imagining a turmeric salad. And I was just like,
Adnan's a resident foodie.
He said like lemon and salt and like, grated.
This is a guy who made cumin cookies, so turmeric, no, but
no, it's just turmeric, raw root turmeric is very fibrous. It's like ginger, but just angrier in many ways.
Ginger and carrot mixed together.
And the danger of turmeric is
the danger.
It stains every mother loving thing on the planet.
Yes.
It's just like, and it will never come off. I had the experience once at the DeKalb Farmers Market in Georgia of my roommate encountering turmeric in its root form for the first time. And he's like, I'm going to taste it. So he starts scraping it with his fingers, and he bites into it, and he hates it. And it's now stained all of his fingers. It's all over his face. And I'm like, you know, on the checkout, I'm sure they have a special line for the idiots who tasted the turmeric, because he looked like jaundiced and sort of mad. And so
this is basically tied to trauma, is what you're saying.
Be very careful with turmeric.
But I think we need to, like, along those lines, like we have to kind of release those conceptions about the cultural foods that stain, that smell, and all that stuff, and share that knowledge. And I understand the trauma associated with that, but like
with being stained,
right? Like
the danger of turmeric,
right? And I'm trying to even like with the exception of one type of apple, hate apples, right? And I'm just like, how do I like reconnect myself?
Okay,
with apples?
So what apple do you not hate?
Honeycrisp apples, organic Honeycrisp apples.
Something that's good.
The one that the you know, black woman at the store looked at me like, you're paying for these apples? Like, right? So it's one of those things that we have to just realize the fact that in terms of the idea of seven generations down the line, we have to change our eating habits in a way that's sustainable for us and sustainable for folks across.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I don't want to just shop here and then it affects people in other countries. Right. Like, how do we make the whole system better?
You have to give up certain foods too, right?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
That are there's from some other regions, right?
Because the problem,
like man can't, yeah.
The problem with having turned it into a global economy is that it's disabled local economy across the planet, right? And so what you're saying is true. We have to think about, you know, sustaining those other economies on the other side of the world, but it would be helpful, I think, for them too, if we were all to go back to a local economy rather than this globalization and free trade. You know, free trade is the biggest oxymoron on the planet.
Well, it's like it's how these different kind of economies.
It's free for them.
Yeah. It's how these different economies kind of feed into each other, because when you're eating food that has to be shipped from Ecuador or wherever else, like, how much gas is that costing, right? Going back to our petroleum jelly type thing.
How
right?
much petroleum jelly?
How much petroleum jelly
does
is
it
that?
Take?
But it's like it really fuels the fossil fuel industry as well. Right. Yeah, so it's this layered thing where it's like by globalizing, putting food production into the global economy, then it kind of has these spin-off effects for these other kind of industries. So it's like by eating locally, you're really doing a lot to, you know, to help the environment and to help get certain types of economies develop, etc. Because these things, they build upon one another.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think we're also taught to eat certain types of foods, right? Like, I remember exposing, you know, a former partner of mine to tofu, and he was just like, oh my God, I never thought it would be this good, right? Like, and it's like exposing people to things like quinoa, or my brother sent me an email, something about Farika? Something.
Fenugreek?
No, not fenugreeks. That's what. Freka. Freekah, right? So it's just like tapping into different things and learning how to cook them differently. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. We have to definitely do that.
Turmeric is one that really interests me, because the healing properties in turmeric are,
right.
I mean, it's awesome. A really, really long list.
Mm. Trauma and healing in the same root vegetable.
Yeah, well, I mean, with that said about my roommate's experience with the turmeric, despite that fact, every time anyone got sick in the house or anything, turmeric was made into a milk or a tea or something, and it was consumed in large quantities. And I don't know how helpful it was, because I think the registers of evaluating that kind of thing are difficult, but at the same time, I felt better. And I just, and I guess that counts for a lot.
Yeah.
So.
Mm. I'm drinking turmeric tea right now.
Oh.
Turmeric and dulce and ginger. But I don't know. I don't know that I agree with you that the measures for looking at, you know, the holistic properties of food, I think that, you know, empirical knowledge is often sold short. Mm. I think there's a lot to be said for it, but it's often dismissed by science, because they feel the methodology isn't as rigorous as theirs. But I disagree with that.
Well, I mean, I didn't mean to sort of dismiss empirical knowledge. It's sort of I don't know how to evaluate it in a kind of. Like, I found myself, the first time I really hit upon, like, how important empirical knowledge is I made myself dal, so like a lentil soup. And I remember back home, you'd always have it with maybe a little bit of rice. And I didn't know that rice and lentils act together to prevent intense gas. And so here I was eating this giant thing of dal, and then I was just laying on the couch. I was like, I am the most miserable person in like a 3-block radius. And I'm hopefully no one will come near me.
But the indigenous knowledge is, you know, it's based in that empirical observation. Mm-hmm. And there is a methodology to it. It's just not in the same paradigm as, you know, Occidental science or whatever you want to call it, mainstream science.
And there's, you know, I've spoken with doctors, and they're like, well, yeah, a lot of these compounds we get, we actually get them from
indigenous
knowledge,
yes,
right?
Exactly.
People, and we just isolate that particular compound and we copyright it. It's like if it's something in, let's say, cabbage, right? You can't really copyright cabbage. Right. I'm sure someone's working on a way to do it, right?
Well, yeah.
You know,
he
turned it up to me because I was the one saying,
I know. Like, well, actually, Adrian, last week, I'm like, I know. But I mean, what Monsanto is doing is not technically cabbage. Like, let's take cabbage and put like a fish gene in and say, this is our cabbage now, right? But it's like, it's real talk, right?
But yeah, they've been trying to patent food.
And people.
In every organic manner. Basically.
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah. Seeds. They're patenting seeds.
But whatever compound they say in cabbage, they'll take that, concentrate it, and that becomes the quote-unquote medicine. And part of the reason why I named cabbage and the idea of indigenous knowledge is like there's a story of my great grandmother, who was, you know, one of those Caribbean women who, something's wrong with you, she picks some bush, put it in a pot, and then you sleep for 4 days, you wake up and you're fine, type of thing.
How's eggplant in a freezer?
Back with the eggplant. Back with that again, eh?
That's a reference.
That's a I don't know what that means. It's a reoccurring thing. The eggplant in the freezer. I'm just, okay.
Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
One day we're going to ask you to explain.
Okay.
Cryptically. Yeah. But it's like, yeah, so the story was that she would, she was diagnosed with high blood pressure. She's like, oh, pressure. Okay. And everyone's like, oh, you know, you got to take your pills. She's like, I don't want to take my pills. Well, you have to take your pills. You got to take your pills. And so she, you know, she was taking her pills so people would get off her back. But she was boiling cabbage and drinking the water or something like that. And then because the two interacted, she actually fell out for a little while because her blood pressure was too low. Because she was doing her own thing. Yeah. You know, I don't know what she ended up doing after. I mean, she lived to 97 or something like that. She was taking good care of herself. But like, yeah, like so people are aware of these things. I don't know how she figured out that boiling cabbage is going to affect your pressure, but it apparently did, right?
Yeah, but I think the process... Sorry, go ahead. Oh, okay, sorry. Hearing voices again. I think the process of, you know, colonization has removed certain things, and we've talked about this, but we've sort of kept traditions and not necessarily understood, right? So growing up, always drink ginger tea when your stomach hurt, right?
Mm-hmm. Like yeah.
It's
just,
yeah. That's what you
it's
do.
It's just
right?
a thing, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there was no necessarily explanation of that. And I know a couple of years ago, a friend of mine, a very close friend of mine, she likes to travel and work in different places. And she's like, I know you'd want this. And she gave me this herb book from Trinidad. Boy, I have not cracked that thing open. It's just there, like, glorified, right? But it's just this thing that, like, we have to start documenting this kind of indigenous knowledge from specific places, right? So I'm sure there's certain herbs in Trinidad that you necessarily might not find in, like, Barbados. But we have to kind of categorize those things and like share with each other on how they will heal us, right? And not just the physical things like foods that will heal us, but the emotional and spiritual ceremonial practices that we do to heal ourselves, especially within the system in which we live when we need it.
Yeah,
you know, take things back and not pay more money for it in the local big chain grocery store versus going down to the West Indian store or whatever to buy it, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's true. And the whole concept of that, you know, resurgence, that's been a theme through Idle No More. That's what we're talking about is a resurgence of indigenous knowledge and culture and honoring those things, because as you say, you know, in the system, it's framed in such a way that we carry some shame about those things because mainstream sort of scoffs at it and looks at it as, you know, primitive or and that's why, you know, that's how this conversation started, because the gaze of Western, I don't know what that is.
Ceases.
For real. That was really weird. Wow. I don't know if people heard that in Radio Land. There was some kind of interference there for a second.
Wow.
Oh, no.
I was not ready.
Yeah. The gaze of Western science and it comes down to that sort of Eurocentric gaze that looks at anything indigenous as not valid or not having that same kind of validity because it doesn't have the scientific rigor that, you know, the pharmaceutical industry loves to ride on yet is clearly abusing.
Interesting. This is sort of connected, but not. Yeah, it's connected. I was watching on History Channel, which I call it, you know, Modern Western Civilization Channel. You know, remember that class in high school?
Yeah.
So, and it was about the makeup of brains of great thinkers.
Oh, I saw that. Einstein.
Right? Yeah, the Einstein. So they're basically studying the makeup of Einstein's brain. And I was like,
so interesting.
It's in some jar somewhere.
Like, well, it's in sections now.
Yeah,
it's
sliced and diced or whatever.
Yeah.
And so they were talking about how, you know, looking at his diaries or whatever, and a lot of his writings where he was saying he was tapping into something
With thought experiments.
Yeah, thought them. Experiments. And Which I was just like,
similar to, wow. It sounded similar to meditation.
Right?
But he called it thought experiments.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so, and yeah, and then they went through similar with other thinkers. And I was just thinking, wow, isn't that just, you know, in, you know, indigenous cultures, they have medicine people or healers.
Exactly.
Like,
exactly.
Is it that they already have that?
I was thinking the same right? thing,
like, just like, they just kind same of thing. Have to divide it up in like...
Well, to make it look different. Like, I was pretty sure, don't have the resource in front of me, but I'm pretty sure that Einstein or was it Newton or one of those guys, they studied alchemy, you know, which is like, what is that if not something that's akin to, you know, indigenous knowledge or practices in that sense. And the idea of, you know, kind of focusing and concentrating, getting to this kind of other kind of zone where things become more apparent. What does that sound like to you? Right? So, I mean, it's a very common practice, but how things get named and how they get valued in this time is based on who does them.
Well, I mean, in some cases, this kind of... this does backfire because in the cases of like Pakistan, the polio campaigns to give polio vaccines have been failing because it's being argued that it's like a Western plot and a plot of Western medicine to overwhelm local knowledges and local ways of dealing with these things, and people's children are dying. And that's a tough one because then you're sort of in this position where you know polio vaccine will do something, but then does it have a spiritual harm? Does it have a harm to the way that these local communities are structured? Absolutely. But at the same time, is this something that you as a state will force using your military power or your police power because you're like, well, vaccines is just one of those things which if we don't protect everyone, the harms are so much greater in the long term. And it usually turns on issues like that is because, you know, you're allowed to have your indigenous knowledge as long as it's ginger tea. But the second it crosses into your ginger tea is going to prevent polio, then maybe we're going to like come in and hold you down and give you the shot. And my concern there is more that there isn't a kind of a robust dialogue where this is explained. I think states get exasperated with local peoples and local knowledges and then just come in and do what they feel needs doing. And it has this kind of infantilizing attitude in the way that it's sold. It's just like, this is best for you and you're going to accept it, as opposed to this is sort of framing it in a way in which that it's that it can be conceptualized or also alternative. So if this community then wants to completely isolate itself and struggle with whatever they're dealing with because they don't want to receive this medicine, that's conceivable as well, right? But then, I mean, there's a concern of children, and these are complicated issues, but I don't think we should uncomplicate them by making it really simple.
Right. No, true. Exactly. Very true. And the thing about polio vaccines, I believe that's the only vaccine that has actually eradicated the disease.
We still got it in Pakistan, but it
because
does.
because people aren't taking the vaccination, but of all the other vaccines, is that the one, or is it smallpox.
There was like I believe smallpox. One case in Yemen in the 90s, and that was it.
Smallpox. I think two. Yeah,
but I mean, a lot of those vaccines are really problematic because the protocols and methodologies they've used to get there have not been. They don't always take into account the health and well-being of the population that they're looking to leak this into. You know, things like long-term effect. And, you know, we're seeing all of these mutations with things like chlamydia and the flu and all of these viruses that, you know, before we were able to treat, and now with the medicines we have to treat aren't working anymore. So those are some of the things that I think we also have to look at when we're speaking about the pharmaceutical industry. Certainly the smallpox vaccination and I would say polio as well are probably two important vaccinations. You can't throw it all out, but there's so many more problems, it seems, than not.
Well, it just, the lens doesn't seem to reflect back on society as frequently as it does, mm-hmm. or should, because then you've got everybody and their grandmother using antibacterial soaps and squirts and everything under the sun, and so you're just constantly dosing yourself with these. Yeah, exactly. You're producing super germs. You're doing the absolute opposite of ensuring your good long health.
Yep.
And that's sort of where it seems crazy, because that's a failure of education on both sides, right? So this is meant to be the highly civilized behavior of also always keeping yourself germ-free, but look what you're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to remind the listeners who are listening to The Vibe Collective, we have to take a very brief break, and we're having a freestyle cypher today. When we come back, we should start talking more about Idle No More. There were some things that happened earlier on in the week, and then also African Liberation Month.
Wow. Shout out to all the artists making money.
Yeah, the one time of the year.
Okay, so we'll be back after this very brief message on The Vibe Collective, CIUT 89.5 FM.
From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM. Toronto.
Vibe Collective, CIUT 89.5 FM. And I'm your host, Jams, your co-host, Jams, and my other co-hosts.
Mally, a.k.a. Docu Vixen.
Adrian Worrell.
Kamba King.
And Adnan Hussein. Hello.
Hello. We're the Vibe Collective. We're heard every Saturday from 3 to 5. We talk about social justice, decolonization, the system. And other things. And then from 4 to 5, either myself and or DJ Butnan and DJ Griffin brings you music to move you. And today we're having a freestyle cypher. And Idle No More is continuing, despite some of the messages that mainstream media is trying to deliver. It is not over. It continues long and strong. And Monday, January 28th, was the first day back for Parliament of 2013, their first day of 2013. And Bill C-45 has now been passed. It's gone through. It is now legislated in a very problematic way. Many are calling it illegal because it not only is it undemocratic as a 450-page omnibill, it includes changes to the Indian Act, and there has been no consultation with Indigenous people, which is not only breaking constitutional laws, but international laws. So Romeo Saganash, who is an NDP MP, tabled a private member's bill on Monday that basically is trying to legislate what should already be law, because Stephen Harper signed the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People back in 2011, yet he continues to ignore that. So Romeo Saganash's private member's bill asks that, or, you know, is trying to legislate that UNDRIP be recognized. So it's crazy. It's crazy. So it's basically a law that's trying to uphold a law that has already been signed by Stephen Harper, but he's ignoring. So that's one of many things that's happening with Idle No More. There were a lot of actions last Monday. You know, lots of round dances, lots of people taking to the streets. And this thing is worldwide. I mean, you're seeing people globally engaging with this from all over the planet. Norway, New Zealand, Australia, Bolivia. I'm seeing folks in different parts of Africa and South Asia. And it's just, it's incredible to see at London, England, at Oxford. They hung an Idle No More banner on one of the Oxford towers. Like, you know, it's pretty powerful and inspirational movement, and it continues to go on. February 21st is the National Education Day for Idle No More. So, you know, there are more events coming up, but mainstream media is trying to frame it as though it's ended.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, with the bills, C-45, I mean, well, it's covers so many things, but I would imagine that it has a lot to do, going back to our petroleum jelly thing, but with the pipeline, like creating opportunities for, or clearing the space to, or crush future resistance against, legal resistance against these pipeline plants.
Well, that's exactly been the problem with this government that under the dictatorship of Stephen Harper, is because with Omnibill C-38, it wiped out pretty much the majority of environmental assessment laws that were in place for the protection of, you know, the environment, that included Indigenous knowledge protocols and protocols for, drawing a blank, protocols for community boards to, you know, make these assessments in Indigenous communities when their community was going to be affected, like, for example, by the tar sands or a pipeline. So Bill C-38 removed all of those environmental assessment laws and then protection laws. And then Bill C-45 with the Navigable Waters Act has completely left all of the water, with exception to it went from, and I've tried to find numbers, I can't find the exact numbers, but I know it was like hundreds of thousands of lakes and rivers that were protected under the
waters
under the Constitution. Oh, okay. and then now, because of this Navigable Waters Act, it's gone down to something like 60 lakes and 72 rivers. And so Greenpeace recently, through the Access to Information law, they were able to find that what these laws are actually is a total and complete acquiesce to the oil industry. Yeah. It's completely capitulating to all of their demands from, or, you know, requests, basically. They weren't, they seem to be pretty cozy with Stephen Harper. So they made these requests and he made it law. And he did it in such an undemocratic way because, you know, MPs didn't have time to read those omnibills. They did not have time to go through 450 pages of you know, legislation that had nothing. All these acts had nothing to do with each other. The change to the Indian Act in Bill C-45 is the land surrender. So it went from having, you know, a majority to you can have less than five people saying, sure, you know, we'll sell the land on the reserve. So, you know, it's completely illegal is what he's doing.
He's making it legal.
Exactly. So, like, it's unilateral changes to legislation. And it doesn't just affect Indigenous people, though this is really important that this is led by Indigenous people, because it does affect them as well. But it doesn't just affect them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I wanted to, just for anyone who's listening, newly.
It's back.
Whoa, that's really strange.
Thank you, CSIS. Okay. So.
Okay.
I'm gonna talk.
It might be the, I was going to say it might be your mic, but no. I don't know what that is. That's really creepy. Okay, what were you going to say, Kemba?
I was going to say, for any of our new listeners who may not have an understanding of I Don't Know More, that and please feel free to jump in, that there were treaties that were signed when the European folks came to this land, now called Canada, also known as Turtle Island by many folks. And these agreements were set in place so that Indigenous communities, the diversity of them, understood that there were ways of negotiating shared spaces, that understanding, because Indigenous peoples here are the original inhabitants of this land. So this is not about something where the Canadian state is entitled to have to do what it wants based on votership. This is something that was agreed upon pre-Canada. Mm-hmm. So I was just thinking about the fact of, you're talking about the Constitution, how many waters are in the Constitution, and the ignorance of the MPs. Many of us who are Canadians, whether by choice or not, don't know about these things in the Constitution. We don't know about many of the laws that are governing our lands. And this is why not only the people who we elect or don't elect, we don't know what's going on, so that we can, you know, kick up a stink. And thank goodness for the folks who have been dedicated to the I Don't Know More movement, who've been posting things around, organizing talk-ins, who have been actually protesting in whatever ways. And I mentioned protest in the most positive way of resistance, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And not for the people who are doing it in unpeaceful ways. So just really have to give thanks and do your research. I love the most recent poster that I posted on my Facebook page about the gentleman who said he was told to go back to where he came from. And he said, so I set up a teepee in his backyard, right? Like, this is Indigenous land, right? Yeah, like, many exactly. of us are visitors, right? Mm-hmm. So go get some edumacation on it.
Totally.
If you have not.
Yeah, absolutely. The problem, we've talked about it so many times, and you know, one of the main topics that we cover on the show is education.
Yeah.
Because you know, that has clearly been the divisive fact here. That's the divisive factor in all of this, you know, with Canadians not understanding the issues because they haven't been educated. Indigenous people are erased from history, from geography, from science, from literature. You know, it's just not part of the curriculum. So Canadians get their edumacation through the media. And the media has done a really piss poor job of covering I Don't Know More because the journalists don't get it, because they're not educated. So, you know, they try and frame it in these ways of, you know, violence or division. And Canadians don't have the critical wherewithal to go, okay, well, so not all the Indigenous people agree. So that means they're divided in this, and that just devalidates the whole thing. Meanwhile, they disagree with their neighbor. But that it never is framed in that way. It's never, oh, well, Canada's divided because we have different political views, right? People just never think about it that way. They want things to be a blanket, and it's not. It's a complicated issue. The worst part is when you're talking to somebody who's lived near a reserve and they say, oh, well, I'm an authority because I've lived near a reserve. I've seen it. I've seen, you know, this, that, and they ramble off, like, you know, the stereotypes. I'm sure you've seen all of those things from all different types of communities, right? That's the first thing. It's not like that's exclusive to a reserve community. Secondly, there are reasons why communities are struggling with these issues, and they are directly related to residential schools and colonization. So, you know, those are the things that are missing in the dialogue.
I want to just clarify mainstream media, because there's a lot of alternative media that have been doing a lot of great work.
Yes,
but
thank you.
I want us to really highlight the effects of colonialism on various communities. Is very important. So I really want to put that out. Like, even those communities of color or different cultures, like, who you see, they make it, like, they have the house and the picket fence or whatever that looks like, there's still a lot of psychological challenges that cause for there to be an unhealthy state, whether it's physical or mental or spiritual, right? So, and, you know, there's no such thing as neo-colonialism, right? It exists. It's happening right now.
Yeah, it's not post-colonial. It's neo-colonial.
Thank you. Sorry.
Certainly. Mm-hmm. But one of the issues, I think, with this is, you know, the four-letter word, right? Jobs, right? And so the idea is, well, yes, we're doing all these things. We're going to create so much work and wealth because by extracting these resources and selling them off to, I guess it's China who we're trying to, you know, kind of saddle up next to with all of this. It's going to create so much economic activity and opportunities for people, and that's what really matters. That's why Canada is not in the same state that the U.S. is in right now, because of our, you know, our kind of economic foresight by our great ministers, etc. And so if, you know, if you want an omelet, you got to break some eggs. And unfortunately, this is what's happening, right? And that's some of the conversation that comes up around things like the oil sands, sorry, the tar sands, I think it is, and likely this pipeline type situation. And again, going back to the idea of education or information, etc., is to explain, well, one, why is it that this short-term economic activity isn't worth all of this? And then also, what alternatives are we creating, you know, to mitigate some of the losses from, you know, the future job losses, I guess, by not having a pipeline network that goes through the whole continent.
That's not job loss. I mean, those jobs don't exist. There are other infrastructures we could be investing jobs in.
Oh yeah, certainly. But I'm talking about in the way that people understand things and how people just, they're saying, okay, well, this is going to create so many jobs. So like, if we don't have that, if we don't have this pipeline, what are people going to do?
Right. How about investing in solar energy? How about investing in wind energy? How about investing in urine-powered batteries?
Like, well, there's not so that much money in urine power.
There are so many alternatives, though, right?
There are so many
alternatives. And I get what you're saying, though.
This is what people are going to be saying.
People are indoctrinated to think.
Certainly.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So in terms of, like, engaging people down the line or even now around these issues is kind of like, well, highlighting that, yeah, well, yes, creating this oil pipeline infrastructure will generate jobs, but it's also going to generate a lot of losses that we don't immediately quantify. And then, of course, the alternatives, like what else can we do to create that kind of, stimulate the kind of economic activity that a lot of people seem to want, because there's a lot of people underemployed, unemployed, et cetera, right? So how is it that we're going to encourage the activity that's going to have people, you know, working in ways they want to work?
But I think we also have to understand who is going to get those jobs, how will they be compensated, and how long will they be compensating for it, right? Because all we know is that there's going to be jobs. I don't know what the benefits of those jobs are. I don't know if, you know, the people who are underemployed are going to be getting jobs, or the people that we conceptualize, right? So it's like having those types of conversations as well, I think, too, is very valuable. And, you know, for me personally, like looking at the ways in which I support this in whatever way, right? Like, so I think that's a very crucial part of this discussion, and being patient with folks. I don't know, you know, my feelings around patience is a work in progress, right? But like, if I choose to be patient with myself about the ways in which I am participating in the tar sands being put into place, I don't know what the word is, then I have to be patient with others, right?
Yeah, I think that we also have to really focus on shifting the dialogue away from, well, this is what is there. So, you know, we have to work with what we've got, because that's pretty much at the crux of, I think, what you were saying in terms of, you know, people believing that this is the answer to our economic problem. Mm-hmm. This is the answer to our, these are the solutions, and they're so short term and short sighted with such a detrimental long term effect. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't add up. So we need to be shifting the conversation into talking about, you know, the economic value of having sustainable energy resource infrastructure. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we're building this ridiculous monster. It's been criticized around the world as being one of the most damaging projects on the planet, to the planet, the tar sands industry.
Mm-hmm. And the thing is like, when has Canada not had a resource-based economy, right? Like, the fact is, like, it's always been that kind of economy. It hasn't changed. We've went from, you know, like, paper, we went to, like, there's never a time where Canada as a state was not operating a resource extract kind of economy base, right?
Well, I mean, I guess if you think about the fur trade, that's sort of the birth of the economy, right? Yeah. And that's a resource extraction,
right?
Human resources too, right?
Yeah. Human resources. Yeah. I mean, the fur trade it's complicated because, you know, fur trading is something that indigenous people have done for time immemorial in a sustainable way.
But that's the difference. Sustainability.
It's right? Sustainability, and it has to do with what you were talking about earlier in terms of the protocols around ceremony and the spiritual connection that people, the spiritual relationship that people have to their environment. You know, and again, that is often dismissed in science, right? It's often viewed as, yet, of course, you can talk about Christ all you want in politics, but, and include, you know, the church in the political sphere, but bring indigenous spirituality into science and it's dismissed immediately.
But I was like more talking about, you know, sort of this crisis of jobs, right? Where, you know, like it's going to create all these jobs. I'm like, but when has Canada not had a resource-based thing? So we've already seen that it creates, you know, jobs for like, you know, what, I don't know, 3 years or whatever, and then there's a fall again. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying, that we have to like kind of break that fallacy that you're creating something new when you're not. Mm-hmm. It's just sort of like this kind of repeat thing. You're not going into anything else. It's just extracting minerals that's going to be gone, and I don't know.
Well, it's the same mentality that kind of we were talking about earlier with regards to like be the vaccines or the sanitizers, where it's like the idea is, well, you create a kind of like intense or state of deprivation where it's like, we need to get something right now. Mm-hmm. We need to get something right now. And even if it's bad, it's better than having nothing. So we need to get something right now. And so once you create that kind of, you're operating in that kind of like kind of danger, scarcity model, then these things make sense.
Yeah.
In a sense, right? Looking at things in a more kind of long-term way, less so. But it's, again, like a lot of these things, they're very much interconnected. So the idea for most people, I would imagine, would be like, well, we know that this is going to be something bad for the environment, but at least it's going to get jobs. It's going to get
I mean, it's the magic word.
I know you're saying it, but it just doesn't make sense to me.
To you.
It's mass hysteria is what it is.
But
it's mass hysteria. It is a massive zombie apocalypse where people are just completely sedated and unable to wrap their heads around this issue. So rather than engage, they shrug and say, oh, well, you know, that we'll leave it to the politicians because they have our back, which, I mean, Harper is selling Canada. It's not his to sell, but he's selling it to China. And Canadians are just kind of shrugging because of that whole rhetoric around the economy and jobs.
And the idea of scarcity and the reality of scarcity in some people's cases, mm-hmm. where people don't have enough. So it's kind of like, well, yeah, but, you know, like, for example, how many people know folks who've like gone to Alberta to work and say, like, you know what, I'm going to be out there. I know it's $22 an hour minimum wage, not minimum wage, but like you can get that easily. I want to just go out there. I want to go out there, bank money. And when I get back, I'm going to figure it all out. It's a similar kind of mentality where it's like, okay, so we're going to run these pipelines and we're going to create a lot of jobs, but then afterwards we're going to figure it all out.
Yeah.
Right. And then the figuring it all out doesn't exactly happen. Then something else happens. Right.
And fracking is another one that is just unfathomable that they're doing, yet they're doing it and continue to do it and wreaking havoc on the planet. Talk about something that's creating earthquakes, mm-hmm. you know, and spoiling water for everybody. But again, it's this mass hysteria of people who are just completely disengaged because they're so sedated by just the numbing effects of technology to get them through their day and focusing on their immediate needs and focusing on, you know, feeding their families and paying their bills and they don't have time to engage with
politics. I think that's a reality in that, and looking towards, you know, culturally where my parents came from and looking at indigenous communities here and other communities, you know, if it's a community. So if someone wasn't doing well, you would give them some food or XYZ, right?
Yeah, so exactly.
It is natural that you're going to think, let me think about jobs, because I don't know that my neighbor or my family member is going to help me if I don't get a job, right?
Exactly.
Mm. Because, you know, EI is only going to take care of me for a year.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And the community aspect is completely eroded, especially in urban centers, because we are in a competition with each other,
right?
Yeah, but just to return to an earlier point which you made as well about how you can refer to Jesus or Christianity very actively in public conversation, it's also a particular brand of Christianity.
Yes,
because
right.
They're like Mujerista philosophy and like earth-oriented salvific theology tends to be a little more, I mean, because the scenario that these groups are trying to present to us, that if you take the idea that human beings are meant to be wards of some divine being on earth, mm-hmm. How exactly are you to account for the fact that, like, so the master leaves you and says, take care of the house, yeah. And you burned it down to stay warm. And it just...
That's a brilliant metaphor.
Burning down the house to stay warm.
I think it's difficult for us to account for these things, and it we don't often apply our spirituality in terms of taking care of the planet, because we're parasitic life forms in that sense. We're bonded to this earth, and so we need to make sure that the host stays alive if we're concerned about the survival of humanity. So,
if.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're not, I mean, that's the problem that our, I think the lack of education and the lack of connection to where your food comes from, how your food is made, et cetera, all of these are all tied in together, because on some level, the more disconnected you've become from the world, right? Like, and so I actually spent this last week learning how to make flour. I really was very interested, because I was like, if I ended up with just a bale of wheat, could I make flour? And could I make a loaf of bread? And I try to do this with myself, like every week. I try and figure something new out. And I feel that it puts me in like it connects me in a way, and not sort of lament generally that a lack of education, but just on a very specific issue. And this all began because my partner, we were at the supermarket, And I'm looking at a bowl of pre-boiled rice that you can heat in the microwave.
Oh, God, I right? saw that package.
Word up, really?
And Uncle Ben.
Never seen that before?
I've never seen pre-boiled rice.
Ew, that's
I was devastated. Yeah. I was spiritually harmed by looking at this plastic
and the canned
pre-boiled
rice.
Yeah.
Canned rice. Canned same
rice.
Thing. Yeah. It's like, really? Really? You can't just... friggin' boil
it's really
some
not
rice.
No,
rice
but I think that's the problem, is that we take this tone with people. Yeah. And
I know,
we,
it's true.
And it, that is not the tone of an educator.
It's true, it's
yeah.
true.
But give it, back but my it, card.
Okay, we got to workshop that.
Yeah.
It's true, we need to find empathy. Empathy, I think, is really hard to come by in these circumstances, because it's frustrating when you're on the ground doing this work and you're dealing with so much resistance from those who you're trying to educate and reach, and it's easy to get cynical, you're right, and it's not helpful.
It's not helpful to be
cynical when you're trying to engage and educate, right? Because you if you're criticizing somebody and ridiculing them for what
they
don't know,
listen, yeah.
they're not going to listen. On the flip side, try and reach out to them with some reasoning. They're not always going to listen either. So it's, you know, it's frustrating work to you know, do any of this kind of resistance-based work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is, it's sort of, because sometimes also, I guess, we as people who consider ourselves sort of like fighting to spread this kind of knowledge and information, forget about the simple interconnectivity of these,
yes.
of your daily lived experience, you know, mm-hmm. So like, how are you going to make your rice? And so, and I feel that the more that people feel empowered in the world, and it's, and I think frequently it's just taking control of something very, I think something easy, like what you're putting into your mouth is something which you can start off with, right? So know where your food came from. And that's not a really It is made difficult when you spend all your meals eating at a restaurant. And in the city, God knows, that's like made really easy for you as well. But I have no idea where anything came from. And I know that it's become a hippie joke to kind of say like, well, like how many hours of sunlight did this chicken get before it turned into my sandwich and questions like that. But at the same time, it sort of gives you that why is that wrong? A life died to make that sandwich for you. So shouldn't you maybe have some sense of what happened?
Yeah, there was a campaign that I think it was Sobeys did for a while. They were selling fish that had a barcode that would give you information about the fisherman who caught it, where it was caught, how it was caught, all of those things. I think we need more of that because we are so disconnected from our food. Mm. And that is one of the most, I think, debilitating things for our indigeneity because it has taken away the responsibility of having any kind of, you know, blood on your hands or dirt in your fingernails or, you know, those things that have allowed us to remember the protocols of a relationship that should be balanced and instead, you know, we're removed from it so we can just consume and not have any thought about the where, the who, the what, the how. And I think that's one of the most radical things you can do is to start taking food growth and all of that into your own hands again and have that as a resurgence. And
there's a lot of community gardens in and around the GTA that you can participate in, you know, so.
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, they're reconsidering the laws or have reconsidered the laws about things like even keeping a chicken in the city.
Yeah.
Like that was something that was being very heavily regulated. I think it came out of the push for public health and how unhealthy this could be, but I think they were dealing with people with large sort of coops on their land, but whereas if you had like one or two chickens, you would probably be fine. And, you know, and the shocking thing is there's this amazing Mitchell and Webb bit that if you go look on YouTube, say Mitchell and Webb farmer, where this farmer is kind of – he's holding this chicken. He's like, it's unbelievable. It just makes eggs. And he's like, seeds. I just throw them out and stuff grows. And it's just – I think that's it's a humble reminder, a humbling reminder.
That's really awesome. Well, it's 4:00. I don't know. I haven't heard from DJ Griffin. DJ Badnan, I don't know if you're – I've got a couple of things I can drop. But I also wanted to –
I thought we had a backlog.
We do. But I also wanted to talk a bit about African Liberation Month. So I think – we'll go to the ads, we'll come back, and we'll continue talking, and then we can get to some music at the halfway point there. Yay. So reminding the listeners, you're listening to The Vibe Collective. If you would like to join in the discussion, you can. Give us a call at 416-946-7000. We're having a freestyle cypher today. We are talking about the usual.
Can they tweet us?
They can tweet at us at Vibe Collective. And they can like us on Facebook.
Yay.
And and we will be back after these messages on CIUT 89.5 FM.
Always wanted to know what our most politically powerful women really think? Listen in to Three Women, the show that features women like Kathleen Wynne, Peggy Nash, Kristen Wong Tam, Christine Elliott, and your host, Sherry DeNovo.
Every Tuesday morning at 9 a.m. on CIUT 89.5 FM.
From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
Vibe Collective, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Jemais. Joining me in studio,
Mally, a.k.a. Docu Vixen.
Adrian Worrell.
Kemba King.
And Adnan Hussein. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for that chocolate.
You're very welcome.
That is yummy. We're the Vibe Collective. We're heard every Saturday from 3 to 5. No. We're breaking with tradition for the last month now. So normally from 3 to 4 we have our roundtable discussions.
It's really wordy.
But And we have a lot to say these days, so we've been pushing it. We're doing roundtable from 3 to 4:30. And then we'll play some music. I promise to play some music today. But we want to talk about African Liberation Month and talk about why we're calling it African Liberation Month rather than what a lot of mainstream calls it, which is Black History Month. Oh,
there it is again.
Hi, Cesis. So
say magic words and they appear.
For real. Okay, anybody want to go in on that, on African Liberation versus African or Black History? Anybody? Bueller?
Bueller?
Yes. Think that when we look at Black History Month, there is a way in which we place the ways in which people of African descent, however you define that, are constantly working to ameliorate not just the experiences of Black people, but people across the world. As opposed to just looking at things that were done in the past, like the civil rights movement or, you know, Harriet Tubman moving with enslaved Africans from the U.S. to Canada. And I think when you say African Liberation Month, there's a key focus on what current movements and historical movements are done to challenge things like racism, colonialism, homophobia, heteronormativity, misogyny, sexism, all of those things, right? So that is why there is a key, I mean, words, language have power. So, I think removing the statisticity of Black History Month and putting African Liberation Month forward is possible. Now, I have some challenges with the whole idea of African Liberation Month, but, I'll let other people weigh in.
I actually I prefer Black History Month for one reason. Is because the British thought of me as black and they thought of you as black.
Mm.
And so Black History Month was black histories is what I would always think of. So the histories of people who have been traditionally oppressed by the culture. I mean, because I always try and think of it as a temporarily located moment, right? And so Black History Month exists because of this culture of oppression that's taken place over the last 400 years or so. And in particular, the black histories, which were united by the stories of empire from Europe, were in India, in Africa, the indigenous populations in Australia, North America. And so these were all blacks.
But I don't want to be linked to you based on, you know, quote unquote, the white man's conception of oppressing me. I want to be linked to you because we both like cumin cookies.
or liberation struggles. You could say the same thing with liberation struggles.
But I feel that's what unifies us is that we have a shared history of trauma and that this month is an exploration of that history. And so I don't know if it's reclaiming the term, but it's kind of, to me, it just, it reminds me that it comes out of that particular history. And so And also the idea of African Liberation Month, I just feel that it locates it in a very particular geography. So it's limiting in one way, and dealing specifically with liberation, it kind of takes that attitude in which always makes me feel a bit uncomfortable when it says, I'm going to tell you you're oppressed because you just don't know it yet. And I understand that that's quite frequently the rhetoric of activists, but I think that, again, is not the tone of an educator. Hmm. So,
my issue with Black History Month, now, if we look at the history of Black History Month or where it came from, it's been around since the 20s. And what have we really... Are people really educated? Like, that's my issue. I don't think... It's pushing towards of actual understanding of how people resisted. And I think liberation frames that, that's the goal, right? History kind of, the history month kind of, it's like in the past. So I think for me, the liberation kind of grounds it in the present and in the future.
I think liberation is like the word liberation is like the Eli Whitney of the English language. Because there was a while when you had like black people celebrating Eli Whitney, and this is the person who invented the cotton gin that kind of actually expanded slavery, right? In a sense, it was like it's this kind of this kind of Trojan horse. Liberation is a word that was imposed on the English by the French as they occupied them, right? So I feel like it's kind of those a little bit of those kind of a trick history in a sense. But as for the concept, I'm more comfortable with African, maybe Black Liberation Month. I don't know, but like what Black History Month has become has been like this very kind of like corporate, depoliticized, whatever exactly that means, type of experience. And there's some value to that. I don't think that everything in that falls under that umbrella is useless or counterproductive. You know, that's not my argument. However, I do think that there, at this time, it might be as useful to have focus on the ways that people resisted, the positive and the negative, because it's, even not every story of resistance is a happy ending per se, right? But to recognize that, yes, people did fight and die and sacrifice and do all sorts of things to create the situations that we're in now, and not just by being the first one to graduate from this school, or the first one to perform this particular kind of surgery, right? In other kinds of ways, and recognizing that as well, I think is important for today. And another thing that I found really interesting too was, and I spoke about this earlier today, was the idea of like African Future Month, you know, where it really focuses on what's 10 years going to look like, what's 20 years going to look like from now. So having that type of awareness and that type of vision, extending the consciousness in that direction, I think is very, very important for, quote unquote, liberation or resistance or what have you. So I really like to focus on the past is very important, you know, recognizing that, but yet also looking at what can happen, what should happen for at least some people in the future.
Mm-hmm. I want to welcome to the show a caller who goes by the name of Student. Student, welcome to the Vibe Collective.
Yes, I thank you.
Okay, so why don't you share with the listeners what you were just sharing with me?
Yes, throughout Black History Month, I've been hearing the questions, who, what, where, when, answered, but I've never actually heard the questions, why and how the ancestors did what they did, and so how could we actually apply that in a practical way to our lives today, so that we can actually reincorporate the spiritual culture and use that as a people to move forward today.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes, thank you for that, Student. That's an important thought. I mean, I think you have to... We as individuals have had to seek out that information. Some of it comes through oral tradition, stories like, some of our heroes, like, you know, Nanny and I'm having
Kwadjo Kwafi. Yeah.
Thank you. You know, those are important stories that we have to look at. And I think that what you're saying is really interesting, the how and the why. Mm-hmm. I think the why is pretty self-explanatory, but the how, perhaps.
Well, in a sense, if I'm correct to assume that you're alluding to, say, for example, the Anansi story. Mm. Well, you see, that is really dealing with our spirituality. But looking at Anansi, if you look, you see that in any situation that Anansi got himself into, he could always come out. And it shows that communication can be used at the higher level for a positive sense. But in the sense of Anansi, it is used to show that at the lower level of our being, then it is dangerous. If you look at then communication systems in terms of journalism, for example, you see how devastating it can be when it is put out there with malicious intent. Mm-hmm. You see also in history how it's used as well when Black history has been given to us from a different perspective, say the European. So in looking at, for example, Anansi, the spiritual teaching in that is essential to understand, but we do not have to a great degree the spiritual cultural background, because all of our, if you will, prior leaders, I mean, going back to Marcos, going to Malcolm, and so on, even before them, they alluded at the psychological implication, but we've never taken it on. Minister Farrakhan came up with Islam, but we never take this on. So we never really look at this because it doesn't seem to be important.
Franz Fanon has done some really important writing about that, and so has Césaire. I was actually speaking about Nanny, Queen Nanny, who, you know, was an important freedom fighter in Jamaica.
Right.
And just looking at the, I thinking about your question, the why in terms of the how, I think is interesting. Like we know the big picture why, but for, you know, looking at why a particular methodology or a particular way of resisting or a particular movement, I think that is an interesting factor to look at in the rhetoric.
I think I like bringing up the fact of sort of storytelling and kind of reclaiming those stories, because I feel that Black History Month, it has manifested since the 20s, but I feel that there hasn't been enough work of reclaiming those missing stories that we need to look at mm-hmm. as tool to be able to like practically implement them, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's something that we need to relook at.
And part of that is like it's a hero industry, right? It's like creating people that, you know, black people can look up to and be proud of and feel like we've accomplished something. And history is often a lot more complicated than that and sometimes has a lot of unpleasant surprises. And so being able to actually engage in history with the knowledge of that and to be able to accept that, mm-hmm. that not everything is going to make you look like a hero or make your people look heroic all the time, but still being able to accept that and see value in all of it in some capacity is important. But again, the way that particularly with the kind of hero industrial complex that part of black history has become, it doesn't allow for the how and the whys, because those are kind of questions that lead us places that aren't often very politically convenient.
Yeah, and the other issue also is that I think we have this very impoverished notion of how history works. In many ways, we think of history as being this closed book, mm-hmm. as something, as a past that we have dealt with or are dealing with in terms of trauma or what have you. But history, like in a more robust fashion, is a way of actually, it's trying to speak to you, I think. And especially when you have people who are embedded in indigenous cultures and things, when people listen to histories and are able to listen to spirits, able to listen to the earth or the way in which it's trying to communicate with you, that history is an active and living entity in that sense, which you're still negotiating with in terms of how you shape your futures. Mm-hmm. And I think when we forget how to listen to history is when we're most impoverished mm-hmm. and we're most alone in the universe. And I think that is the danger of the kind of secularist rhetoric that leaks into the teaching of history. That we have to be very careful about avoiding, because history is much more nuanced than merely that social studies book that you got in the past.
But in looking at the history, then by whose definition do we take history? Because to me, history is really the science of understanding the psychological effect that then is recorded. So by understanding history, we are really looking at the mind, or if you will, the soul of a people. So if we were to look at history in that way, what then are our ancestors telling us by way of an ancient story? Or for take, for example, then, how when we look at communication, how do we really see that we're conditioned to communicate with our very self? If I take what you're saying or alluding to it, indeed, this is not a word, I make this one up, nakify. We never nakify ourselves to ourselves. That is, we never really look at ourselves in a honest, impartial, objective way, such that we neither justify nor condemn, accept nor reject what it is that's going on inside of us, but look at ourselves just as we actually are, not as we think we should be or as someone else thinks we should be. So if we look at it, indeed, it can be very painful. And for that reason, I think we become very evasive, even to ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I want to thank you for calling in today, student. It was good to hear from you, good to hear from our listeners.
And I think that's a very powerful assessment that you offered us.
Yes, yeah, definitely. So thank you so much for calling in.
You're welcome.
Okay, stay tuned, eh? Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
I just wanted to, the caller said Islam was started by Farrakhan. I just want to clarify, I think the caller was referring to the Nation of Islam, which was actually started by Farid Muhammad, I believe, so in the States. So just to clarify that information.
Thank you.
No problem.
Yeah.
Also, Ajamu Nagoya, who's a part of the Network for Pan-African Solidarity, who has been a guest on this show most recently, has written a piece on rabble.ca entitled Why Black History Month Should Be Called African Liberation Month. Mm-hmm. And one of the specific things that he speaks to is that it is a time for people, especially people who identify as of African descent, to rededicate themselves to movements or ways that will liberate African people, whether it is locally or globally. So I think that's an important point, and I'm really actually still working through in my head what Adnan has just shared about, you know, the unifying factors of using the term black, because I've heard this, you know, with even within the black community as well. But I think there are ways in which that homogenizing factor also kind of restricts us, right, in terms of learning about the even within so-called phenotypically, this is so problematic, black communities. Now, then we get into a conversation about race, which I can't do right now. But you know what I mean? Like all the cultures within it, like it's still it's a homogenizing and limiting way even to use the term black, because I
do it not so much as a means of homogenization, but as to opening the realm of what should be discussed when these things are connected. Because, for example, if you were to take something like Sharia law or the way it was conceptualized by colonists, so it was bred in this lab in India, basically, in the 19th and 18th centuries. It was created by local consultants who were sort of paid and compradors and worked with the colonial forces to generate something which was which eviscerated the native traditions of how this stuff was engaged. Then it was taken and moved to Kenya. And so the Indian way of engaging with Sharia law and Islamic law and whatever, however that works, was then exported to places like East Africa and then used on the populations there. So a law which is twice abstracted from them and in kind of a way implicates how these sort of – how colonialism moves through that. So the funds which made possible expansionism into Africa sometimes came from places like India. And I think knowledge of that is very important, and sort of – and that connectivity of how these stories of oppression sort of are linked, I think, is central to understanding to making this history more robust and not kind of isolating it, I feel.
Mm-hmm. Well, because I think we tend to look at, you know, any of these types of subjects in a binary, and it's important to be able to recognize how our histories connect. And I think that's the only problem I have ever had with Black History Month, is because it removes the colonizer from the story of how come we have to have Black History Month.
Yeah. Well, not necessarily. They're sponsoring it now.
But do you get what I'm saying? Because you have the settler people who are of European descent are not necessarily going to engage beyond, say, Martin Luther King or Harriet Tubman. They're not going to look at the history connected to their own history. Mm. They're not going to consider that history. That's the only issue I've ever had with
that's
it.
That's why we need White History Month.
Oh, Lord, no. That's every month.
I know.
Yeah, exactly. Just making your sarcasm very clear to the listener.
Sorry.
Who might not be familiar with...
with me every week?
With sarcasm in general.
Okay.
Sounds like a good idea to me.
Some people take things literally.
It's true.
But that whole conversation.
I actually would be fascinated to to generate a what.
And what would that look like?
Who would the heroes be of a White History Month? Like that would be really interesting.
Yeah. There are all of the yes, exactly. Thank you.
I got a whole list for you.
Really? I would love to see because I think people would try and put Jesus on there. And
definitely.
Not a white man. not a
But Lincoln, Columbus. But
isn't there like white ethnic JFK. Studies? Like, wasn't that one of the biggest things
isn't it bizarre that you put Lincoln up as someone as a representative of a White History Month when his contribution is the emancipation of slaves?
Yeah, but like, he did that for economic reasons.
And it was political, exactly.
Economic.
Yeah.
Is Spielberg doing the allowing people to see the movie for free this month or something? Like,
somehow, I think not.
Oh, no.
There's money to be made.
They're making money off of it anyway. So.
Yeah. This is great.
And how would they differentiate it from other month?
Exactly.
I remember that happening, and I actually found this as one of the more powerful expressions of community. When I came to America for the first time, it was right about when Schindler's List came out, and the Jewish community in the parts of Massachusetts which I was in was paying for high school students to go and see this film because they thought it was significant for people to have this experience. And I find that it's odd that people don't kind of rally behind other films in the same kind of way, that like I haven't heard of too many communities paying for students to go see this film because it's culturally significant or what have you.
Django.
Oh God, yeah. No.
Well, I don't know. What would you show them? Because in that case, and there was a lot of debate about whether or not that should be how this is playing out. Is that a good idea? The film is dramatic. Should kids be seeing it? There was all of these discussions happening at the same time. But yet, that was something that was actually taking place.
Well, I remember when Malcolm X came out, people at community centers, they're like taking kids to go, you got to see this film. That was 1992.
Yeah. I think similar to that, I think maybe we don't see that, you know, happening where communities will pay for students to go, but within communities of color, communities of resistance, we have pay what you can, we have free things. Exactly. There's different things that do happen, but it's not necessarily highlighted in that way because.
So, because we mentioned Django, I just wanted to say, like, you know, I was thinking about this and how, you know, within the North American context, how that, you know, a large portion of the actual, like, time frame has been left out. Like, how many films is there even on slavery? There's, like, what, two?
Yeah, Amistad.
That wasn't in the United States. It was on its way there.
Right. Like, yeah. Right.
Didn't
you know what
it.
I mean? Like, it's and kind of insane.
There was Roots.
There was, that's it.
The Beloved.
The miniseries.
That's it.
Beloved.
There's been three films. Yeah. Like,
so sad I couldn't even answer this question if you asked me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I mean, but not
that's
even
a lot of American history.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, well,
it's true. That is completely erased.
Yeah.
They did have the other sort of, they had Glory.
Okay, Glory, right.
As well. And
Queen, Halle Berry, Queen.
I don't know that one. Oh, Queen. Denzel. I know Queen. No, I'm saying I don't know Glory.
Denzel.
Denzel, no? Yeah. Glory, I forgot about Glory. But I mean, come on.
But this is difficult,
it's like how
right?
many?
It's well, I mean, true. How what many happened to that film that Danny Glover was making?
He's still making
Toussaint?
It.
Toussaint?
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's supposed to happen. In process, I guess.
Maybe the same time Denzel's Hannibal comes out. But I mean, if you want to ask other questions, like how many films about pre-colonial Africa have you seen?
Yeah, that too as well.
Pre-colonial here.
Oh, pre-colonial.
How about that? Like, let's see more of that. And further to that, how many films on you know, indigenous experience of colonization have you seen? Or there's some great films in the indigenous. I'm really proud of the indigenous film work that's out there, but you know, it's limited because there's limited funding, there's limited, you know,
and then resources
and limited distribution. So
and then so but how many films do we see about World War II? Exactly. Like every month, really.
Exactly. And the Holocaust. Like, how many films are there about the Holocaust? Okay, so we on that note.
Yep.
On that happy educator note.
Well, I just, like, to just comment on that, I think the reason why the Holocaust tends to show up as much as it does is that because it's something it's something which I think was more eye-opening because there was it shattered the civilizational dialogue of the 19th century. It to say that European society was more cultured, higher, and better, and then to see what they did to their own was so shattering,
right.
that is something that they keep revisiting. And I hope, and I actually hope, that we don't stop visiting Holocaust histories, but we use it as a gateway to seeing other suffering as opposed to eliminating it.
Yes, I think we need to look at multiple Holocaust mm-hmm. histories, not just the one that took place in Europe. But we are at the end of our half hour, extra half hour. I want to get to some music because the people do tune in for some music as well as the sound of our voices, hopefully. So, yeah, we'll come back on the other side, but just to remind the listeners, you're listening to The Vibe Collective. We are Jams.
Mally, a.k.a. Docu Vixen.
Adrian Worrell.
Kemba King.
And Adnan Hussein.
And, tune in, stay tuned, rather, for some music on the other side of the break here on CAUT 89.5 FM.